Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Do new security procedures make you feel safer when you're flying?
We're still statistically much more likely to get in an accident before getting on the plane than a terrorist incident occurring on the plane. So yes, I feel very safe traveling on the plane.
Sure, it's minor inconveniences for us, but if you grew up in Cuba, Pakistan, or Saudi Arabia, you face body scans that reveal your naked silhouette and TSA agents patting down your arms and legs. Definitely more likely to disclose an underwear bomb than a metal detector, but only if you travel from Yemen or 13 other countries. Underwear from Britain is fine. Give me a ticket, but not from Yemen. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, January 5th, and The Takeaway is, how closely can you seal the borders? At some point, you have to stop letting people come to the United States. It seems that's the only sure way to prevent terrorism.
Well, is the whole world becoming a no-fly zone?
That's a good question.
Yeah, but let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. We're learning much more about the suicide bomber who killed 7 CIA officers in Afghanistan last week. He was reportedly a Jordanian doctor, recruited by Jordanian intelligence, and taken to the CIA base in the hopes he could infiltrate Al-Qaeda high command. The bomber was a double agent, though, who blew himself up at the meeting, killing those 7 CIA officers. Last night, the top NATO intelligence official released a report saying the CIA is only, quote, marginally relevant in Afghanistan. The report says the CIA doesn't know enough about the Afghan people, their economy, and the power brokers there.
The White House is taking steps to improve its intelligence on our airline security. Deputy White House Press Secretary Bill Burton says officials have been combing through the nation's database of possible terror suspects since the Christmas Day attempted bombing of a U.S. jetliner.
Probably thousands upon thousands upon thousands of names were scrubbed, and probably dozens were moved to different lists.
Those different lists include the no-fly and terror watch lists. That comes on top of the new security procedures now in place, as this international traveler at Newark Airport describes.
You had to take off your coat. They went through your bag. They did a body check. There was a line for women, a line for men. But it wasn't bad. Everybody was very polite.
Let's talk about that more now with Nuala McGovern, host of the BBC's World Have Your Say. Good morning, Nuala.
Good morning, Celeste.
You spent a program, you've been collecting voices from around the world responding to these new security procedures. What's the sense from the people you talk to? Is it outrage or is there acceptance?
I think there's really a variety of opinion, and it depends who you speak to. I think it runs the gamut of emotions. We did hear about shock and outrage and embarrassment from one TV host in Nigeria who says that they cannot believe that there's a change in policy and a list of 14 countries due to one Nigerian would-be bomber. We also had Todd in Atlanta who thought, you know, cut to the chase, let's just all go through security in our underwear if that helps things. And meanwhile, Shakot in Karachi, he believes the U.S. is being a paranoid nation and wouldn't be surprised if brain scanning is next.
Do you think this is going to keep people from traveling to the U.S. or is this going to all blow over?
I think it's difficult to say just yet. I know I think people will continue to travel and probably try it out. There is a great deal of resentment out there. And probably the main thing is a great deal of uncertainty of exactly how effective the new security checks will be.
Okay, Nuala McGovern, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a minute.
In the eastern U.S., that deep freeze isn't going to change anytime soon. The northern plains seeing wind chills of 20 to 30 below. The teens this morning in parts of the southeast. Birmingham, Alabama has officials using a local arena as a warming station.
Our local homeless shelters are already at or near capacity over the past several days. And certainly will be with this weather coming in.
In Florida, it's farmers who are worried about the freeze damaging this year's citrus crop. Health care spending rose 4.4% in 2008 to more than $7,000 per person, but it's the smallest increase since spending was first tracked 50 years ago. The recession is the culprit. Asian markets were up. European indices mixed. Futures now slightly up. The Dow gets underway at 10,583. The S&P opens at 1,132, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,308.
If you've been laid off, is taking an unpaid internship the path to a new career? We're going to talk about this later this hour, and we're asking you about flying this morning. What is too much in terms of restrictions? 8778-MY-TAKE. good morning. On the BBC interactive program called World Have Your Say, people from all over the world have been responding to the new airline regulations. Here's Shakat from Karachi, Pakistan.
The funny part of it, the people that I've spoken to here in Karachi, and this is just evidence of the paranoia, they think, and this will never end. Today is profiling, tomorrow is going to be brain scanning, tomorrow, third day is going to be bracelets, electronic bracelets and all that. There's just no end to it.
Pakistan is one of 14 nations on the list that the United States now considers to be at-risk nations, where the citizens of those countries are going to have to face tighter security restrictions at airports. We're joined now by Eric Lipton, Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. And Eric can explain these restrictions and how they work to us. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
So walk me through this process. For example, if I hold a Nigerian passport, I'm going to be checked at every single U.S.-bound flight?
That's the intention that the Transportation Security Administration has, and it has imposed that upon airlines that fly to the United States. It's essentially told them that if you want the privilege to fly to the United States, any time that you have a passenger that's boarding your flight from any of these 14 countries, that individual must be patted down and their carry-on bag must be double-checked, usually at the gate, before they can enter the plane.
Okay, so what if I'm an American citizen, if I'm me, and let's say I start in Israel and I'm flying to the U.S., but I have a quick stop over in Sudan, then what happens?
Well, then you would be included in this net of people who would be subject to the mandatory additional check. So it is anyone who is a citizen of any of those 14 countries, as well as anyone who is taking a flight that originates from or passes through any of those 14 countries. So you then would be subject to the mandatory additional screening.
Okay, there's been obviously a lot of criticism from these 14 countries that are on the list. What kind of criticism is all about profiling?
Well, the response that I heard from some diplomats who represent those countries, for example, the ambassador to Algeria, is that, and also from in Nigeria and in Pakistan, I heard criticism, is that essentially you're suggesting that every one of the citizens of our country is a suspect, and that the presumption here is that simply because there are some people who have at some point been associated with our country that, you know, perhaps were related to Al-Qaeda, that therefore everyone in our country should be essentially considered a suspect. Well, and that they consider that offensive, and that the real answer here is to have a robust security system and robust intelligence program that prevents a terrorist from getting on planes, not to sort of look at all citizens of a country as being potentially a terrorist.
Well, but Eric, that's what I'm not clear on. What is the official language here? Are they calling these countries at risk, or are they calling them the axis of annoyance, the 14 nations?
Well, it's an interesting term that they use. They call them countries of interest.
Ah.
That's the term that they use. It's a sort of a gentle way of saying, you know, countries where we think terrorists may be.
Okay, so the question is, they make a distinction, though, between the four countries that they say sponsor terrorism and those countries that are of interest because they have terrorist camps originating?
So the list is made up of two parts. One is countries that are officials, what they call state sponsors of terrorism. It's a list that's made up by the State Department, and that includes countries like Iran and Cuba and Sudan. And then there's the other countries that are the countries of interest, that at some point there has been Al-Qaeda presumably associated with being present in those countries or being affiliated with people who are from those countries. It's much more ambiguous exactly how you get on that list.
Okay, Eric Lipton, thanks so much. He's a Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. And as Eric was talking about, the criticism is that clearly most of the people that live in these nations are not affiliated with terrorism, nor are they have any plans of causing any kind of violent act on flights to the United States. Back with us is Nuala McGovern, host of BBC's World Have Your Say. And Nuala, you heard all kinds of people from all over the world. I wanted to listen to Susanna from Kingston, Jamaica.
I was profiled. I was searched four times before I left Kingston, Jamaica. I was searched when I reached the airport, when I reached the end of the corridor to get on the plane, when I came off the plane, because obviously I might have gotten off the plane in midair and done something. Nobody else was searched.
Clearly she's a little bit ironic about the fact of her threat as a terrorist suspect.
She is indeed. And in fact, Susanna went on to say that she weighs 100 pounds and if she had her coin in her pocket, you could see the date on it. So she didn't think that. She thought they were unfairly profiling her. And one of the really interesting points I thought which came up last night was this whole idea of a substitution strategy. And what that means really is if you profile certain nationalities or a certain group of people, will the people who are then trying to commit terrorist acts then just go to a different group, to somebody that you're not expecting to profile? I thought it was quite interesting. We had one commenter, Ibrahim, in the UK, who really thought this, that they would just then go outside of their group. He mentioned Egyptians and Jordanians not being on the list. And funny enough, one of the main stories this morning, of course, is the CIA double agent who, in fact, turned out to be right. Jordanian. So I thought that was quite interesting. And we couldn't seem to come to an agreement with the different people who were calling about whether a substitution strategy would really happen or not. One person said, how many female Swedish Quaker terrorists have you met? So the debate went on.
Deep sleeper cell, I guess that would be.
I guess so.
You know, Nuala, I think I was also surprised by the some of the people who called in and talked about getting extra screening for kind of strange reasons. This is Vivian calling from Spain.
In my case, the unusual was that I was resident in Paris at the time, but my ticket had been purchased in Frankfurt. So immediately, I go into a category that merits having questions. I was taken into a room. All my clothes were removed.
And that's where that comment ends. So I guess we're supposed to guess what happened after all of his clothes were removed.
He said he had like one little something on his passport that then kind of triggered him to get checked. But he did seem to have a problem with that. I mean, the searches are a big part of it. The one thing is the Nigerian would-be bomber last week, even if he had the full pat-down, etc., that they're now bringing in, it still wouldn't have detected the bomb. Number two, we had Pat Brown, who's in favour of profiling, and she said she feels Italian authorities do it really well and that she was frisked so completely that she felt she was dating the woman by the end of it. Mm. However, this is a thing, how far can searches go or should the argument be more towards searches instead of profiling a certain nationality?
Was there any sympathy with the American feeling that they're unsafe, that there's a terrorist threat on the airlines?
Oh, yes, there was. There was indeed. Some people thought that, let's do it. It's going to take an extra 15 minutes. Other people, of course, particularly those on this list, felt targeted.
Nuala McGovern is host of the BBC's interactive show World Have Your Say. Thanks so much for joining us. It's now 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the headlines.
Well, a mixed message this morning from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on the nation of Yemen. The Secretary of State has praised Yemen for recent action to disrupt al-Qaeda, but said more still needed to be done.
It's time for the international community to make it clear to Yemen that there are expectations and conditions on our continuing support for the government.
The Detroit Christmas Day airliner suspect was reportedly sent on his mission by al-Qaeda in Yemen. Back at home, the president is meeting with his top advisors today to discuss airline security following that failed attack. Following the president's meeting, he's expected to make an announcement on new security measures.
Meanwhile, the former head of security at the Israeli national airline El Al says new U.S. airline security measures are not enough. Speaking to us earlier on The Takeaway, Isaac Yefet says El Al employs expert interrogators to interview all passengers before departure.
If you know how to hire the right people, qualified, train them well, test them nonstop, anyone who failed, he is out. No mercy in this kind of work. We are dealing with life.
And Google's expected to unveil its plans for a mobile phone today. The Nexus One is the first smartphone designed by the company's own engineers. Also, Bella, the name of the Twilight series heroine, has surpassed Max as the most popular dog name last year. That's according to veterinary pet insurance company. Top dog names also include Lucy, Molly, and Buddy. For cats, Max, Oliver, and Tiger. We'll see if that one remains a popular name in 2010. That's
dicey.
A look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, oil prices surging. And how's that affecting your heating bill? We're going to talk about it in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some quick takeouts on the news for you. We'll start with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And Louise, oil has suddenly topped more than $81 a barrel. And this obviously is not good news during cold weather. What's going on?
Well, it's good news or it's bad news. It depends on your perspective, as with so much of the economic news. But it's been hovering between $70 and $80 since July. And you're right, it went above $81 yesterday. And what's going on is that there was built-up demand from manufacturers and from companies to produce more inventory in the last month. That's why we had some positive manufacturing numbers again that came out yesterday from December. And as they do this, they're using more oil. Mm. And so the positive news is that maybe this is a sign that manufacturing is coming back. If manufacturing comes back, maybe we get jobs back. But then the negative news is when you go to the gas pump, these prices are horrible. They're up 6 cents in the last week. Get this, they're up a dollar from a year ago. Wow. So it'll really cost you when you drive and when you turn on your heat.
And now put these numbers for me in perspective in terms of manufacturing, because before we were in the worst manufacturing slump since the Great Depression. So yes, we're getting good news, but is it bringing us back to former levels, or is this just good news after a really, really bad time?
It is bringing us back. This is the fifth straight month of improvement in that Institute for Supply Management Index, which we all watch carefully. This is the highest level since April of 2006. Okay. So it is really improving, but there are some real questions on whether it's going to continue. And I think whether it will continue or not is going to be whether those gas prices, you know, get so high that people don't spend money, and whether there's jobs given to people that they can go spend money. And that's a real question.
Sustainability seems to be the big question for the beginning
of the
year. That's
right. Sustainability
so
in the economy.
Right. Louise Story, Takeaway finance contributor and finance reporter for the New York Times.
You know, when people look for oil prices as a sign of demand in the economy, it's definitely different, interesting times. Well, David Zirin joins us now. Dave, haven't talked to you in a while. Good morning.
Hey, great to be here, John.
He's, of course, writer for edgeofsports.com and the author of A People's History, Sports in the United States. So we're going to talk about the NFL going to the U.S. Supreme Court next Wednesday. The NFL claims it's not a monopoly, or it claims that they don't have to, obey antitrust laws. Which is it?
Yeah, this is like the Super Bowl for lawyers. This case was brought against the NFL by the sports apparel manufacturer American Needle, who back in the day had licensing deals to produce hats, jerseys, and other merchandise for NFL teams. Now, American Needle took the NFL to court after the league gave exclusive merchandising rights to Reebok, American Needle saying they weren't given the right to compete with Reebok by approaching individual teams to put out their gear. The NFL says that even though they're made up of these individual teams that run businesses separately, they actually operate in a collective manner and therefore are exempt from all antitrust laws. Now, what's interesting about this is that the NFL has won this every step of the way in the legal process, and when American Needle took it to the Supreme Court, the NFL said, yes, let's go to the Supreme Court, let's do it, because what the NFL wants is the Supreme Court to actually issue a ruling that's even broader than the issue of merchandise, and say once and for all, yes, the NFL is antitrust exempt. It is one entity. It does not have to follow any of the Sherman Antitrust Act laws.
Now, that's interesting. So they're betting and feeling pretty confident going into this Supreme Court, this Super Bowl for lawyers next Wednesday. But, you know, around Super Bowl time, it's amazing to me the power and reach of the NFL. I mean, there are certain advertisers who've paid to say the word Super Bowl in their ads, and then others who have to use the big game nomenclature. I mean, how can the NFL be like baseball? Baseball gets an explicit exclusion from antitrust. NFL never got that. What are they arguing?
Well, they want it so badly because also this, for the last generation, you could argue that the power of sports has been in the hands of the unions. And this would really put a lot of the power and set amazing precedent to put power in the hands of ownership. I mean, it's a lot more than just them jacking up the prices of a fitted cap. They could then openly collude on salaries for players and coaches. You know, the anti-collusion trials would be things of the past. They could put down as fiat things like blood drug testing.
Right.
And the NFL's collective bargaining agreement expires in March 2011. If the Supreme Court rules for the NFL, this would almost certainly provoke a lockout or a strike, which would jeopardize, of course, the very game.
On some level, the NBA and the NHL are probably on the sidelines here cheering, even if quietly. Dave Zirin, thanks so much. He's a writer for edgeofsports.com and author of People's History of Sports in the United States. He's a correspondent also for The Nation magazine.
Our last takeout comes from you on this first Tuesday of the new decade, or is it?
This is not the end of the first decade of the 21st century. Next year, 2010, will be the last year of the first decade of the 21st century, just as 2001 was the first year of the 21st century, not 2000.
Larry is right, John. Yeah. You can hem and haw, but he is right.
That's the message. Do the math, guys. Dan emails us. Year one was the first year of the first decade. There was no year zero, and year 10 was the last year of the first decade. It's a mathematical fact. Happy New Year.
And Charlie writes, I hope you'll agree and be the first in the media to take notice.
Well, yeah, he's got a point. I mean, remember back to the year 1970.
The long and winding road.
Sing it, Paul. 1970, you see, was actually part of the 60s. I remember it. I was there. The 70s began later with Watergate and disco.
I wouldn't know. At that point, my life was measured in months. But getting out of this, we've been asking for new news predictions for the new year and the new decade, whatever you want to call it. Here's one dire warning.
This is Tom calling from Detroit, and I think in 2010 we are going to be grappling with the ever-increasing problem with robots.
Finally, robotic beings rule the world. The humans are dead.
Well, there are a lot of unemployed robots there in Detroit. They actually have something to worry about there.
Yeah, but, you know, their cost of living is pretty low. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org to weigh in with whatever you have to say. Coming up, we're going to be talking more about the suicide bombing in Afghanistan that took the lives of 7 CIA agents. Turns out it was all done by a double agent. More on this very developing story in a few minutes.
Good morning, everyone. The CIA trusted him, but he turned out to be a suicide bomber in Afghanistan last week. Coming up, we'll talk about what the implications are for the CIA in Afghanistan. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama will meet with his national security team this afternoon, where he's expected to announce further changes to the airline security watch lists, and that whole policy is being reviewed. In Yemen, the U.S. embassy has reopened. The move comes less than a day after Yemeni forces say they killed 2 al-Qaeda militants during a gun battle. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to New York Times Paris bureau chief Steve Erlanger in Yemen, who told us the government there has little authority over most of the country.
Huge parts of Yemen are essentially empty lands where dragons lie.
And for that reason, Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, says Yemen will always be linked to terrorism.
Think of this as like fighting disease. Yes, yeah, you every once in a while you make some progress, but you never eliminate the virus. We're not going to eliminate Yemen as a place where the virus of terrorism exercises itself.
That virus of terrorism Richard Haass is talking about has reportedly entered into an alliance with another scourge, Colombian organizations who smuggle cocaine. For the first time, U.S. authorities are establishing a link between al-Qaeda and cocaine dealers in Colombia. Officials tell Reuters it's become tougher to move the drugs from Colombia straight to Europe. The cartels are going through Africa with the help of al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups based there. In business news here at home, General Motors says its sales in China surged 67% last year. But revenues from GM sales in the U.S. market are higher. That's because GM sells vehicles in China for less than they do at home.
Thanks, guys.
Taking a look at the markets, futures are up a little bit now. The Dow gets underway at 10,583. The S&P opens at 1,132. And the NASDAQ will start at 2,308. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So as more details emerge about that bloody suicide bomber who killed 7 CIA employees and 1 Jordanian intelligence official in Afghanistan last week, perhaps it more than anything highlights the challenges now facing the CIA and the U.S. attempting to cultivate covert sources in Afghanistan to assist in counterterrorism there. The bomber was a double agent, someone the CIA had recruited to spy on senior al-Qaeda leaders. He was also a Jordanian doctor, this was mentioned already by one of our BBC colleagues, who had been imprisoned and presumably turned away from al-Qaeda while in the custody of Jordanian security officials. Joining us now is Anand Gopal, reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Kabul. And let me just say hello and go right into a question. Is there any sense that al-Qaeda has found a way to tap into the stream of people that the CIA might actually cultivate as sources to turn them into suicide bombers, or is this a bit of an accident here?
Well, that's certainly the concern, and there's some history here that this has happened before. In the 90s, there was a double agent that had worked both with the CIA and al-Qaeda, but of course, this is the first time such an agent has been used to such deadly effect.
And, you know, NATO has issued a report today saying that the CIA has all kinds of problems in Afghanistan. Is this an additional one, or is this always a problem that they've had, that people who they're likely to trust as sources, people who they think they can turn, may actually be likely to put on a suicide vest?
Well, I think this has always been a potential problem, but we've never gotten where actually somebody has been able to penetrate to the extent of going and killing seven or eight CIA employees. But I think it's really going to cast a shadow now on all future intelligence, what could happen in the country.
I guess what's really frustrating about this as an observer of what's going on, and most Americans, of course, are aware of the troop surge that's taken place in Afghanistan. In many ways, the tip of the spear here is not the soldiers that have gone over to stabilize the country, it's going to be this counterterrorism effort. I mean, if the CIA can't cultivate sources and produce covert operations in Afghanistan to deal with counterterrorism, the number of troops in the surge isn't going to matter. Am I wrong about that?
Well, definitely, and especially against the fight with Al-Qaeda. Remember, Al-Qaeda is mostly across the border in Pakistan, so U.S. troops can't actually go on the ground and try to find them. So to find the senior leaders like bin Laden and Zawahiri, it's almost completely reliant upon intelligence, which they can then use for drone strikes. But if the intelligence becomes a problem, then it becomes very difficult to get these leaders.
Now, I don't know, Anand Gopal, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, if your reporting has gone into this at all, but has Pakistan had similar problems where they've cultivated individuals who turn out to be double agents and it resulted in bloody bombings, suicide bombings, or other terrorist attacks against the very people who they were trying to trust?
Well, it's even more complicated in Pakistan because you have the ISI, which is the intelligence agency there, which is, according to some, sort of trying to play all sides. The ISI maintains some connections to insurgent groups at the same time the other sections of the ISI is actually trying to fight against those same groups. So it becomes extremely complicated. There have been a number of times where ISI headquarters have been attacked in the last 2 years, and some people have suggested, although there's no definite proof, but some people have suggested that that may be because of some intelligence failures like we saw in Afghanistan.
Let's shift gears for a moment. The other detail that really complicates matters or, you know, stands out here is the fact that this individual is apparently a Jordanian who the Jordanians attempted to turn while he was in custody in Jordan. Now, Jordan, of course, has a great reputation in dealing with counterterrorism within its own country, dating back to the 1970s and the whole Black September movement against, you know, the Palestinians, and the King Hussein was very, very effective in Jordan. What does this mean if a Jordanian individual is showing up in a place like Afghanistan?
Well, it means a couple of things. First, the involvement of Jordanian intelligence officials in Afghanistan is sort of in a secret, and I think it's a very sensitive issue in Jordan. So now this has kind of come out, and it probably makes it more difficult for the Jordanians to be involved over here. But secondly, I mean, there is still, even though the Jordanians have clamped down to an extent, there are still extremists who are coming from Jordan and other areas in the Levant who are ending up in places like the border areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And, of course, the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan are believed to be mostly Arabs. Certainly, Osama bin Laden is an Arab from Saudi Arabia, from southern Saudi Arabia. Is that the sort of tactic here, that the CIA is trying to match the Al-Qaeda Arabs in Afghanistan with Arab spies and Arab operatives of its own, and this is a pretty significant failure?
Well, I think so. I mean, the Arabs who are mostly in Afghanistan and Pakistan are very well protected, and it's very hard to get to them. And they don't trust outsiders, especially even Afghans or Pakistanis. They have a hard time trusting. So if you want to penetrate that inner circle, then the best way to do it is to actually recruit other Arabs to do it.
What is the view on the street in Afghanistan here? I mean, you know, there's a lot of cynicism about the Afghan government. There's a lot of concern about this surge. But in many ways, I would think Afghans view this as an Arab-to-Arab conflict, Al-Qaeda versus the CIA, and not something that involves their own tribal networks.
I think that's right. It's gotten the story's gotten considerably less attention here in Afghanistan than it has internationally. And part of the reason is that Al-Qaeda as an organization is very weak in Afghanistan. It has very little presence. It's not involved in the day-to-day fight. It's mostly across Pakistan. So most ordinary Afghans don't really think a lot about Al-Qaeda, or it doesn't figure into their view of things.
That's interesting. Well, of course, you know, let's remind people, seven CIA employees and one Jordanian intelligence officer were killed in that attack in Afghanistan last week. Does the CIA need a victory now to sort of reassert its initiative here?
I think it would look very good for them if they were able to kill or capture a major al-Qaeda leader across the border. It would certainly help them turn the momentum around.
And, of course, the question would be, did they actually get the leader, or was the leader sort of given up tactically? It's hard not to conclude that al-Qaeda is really running the show at this point, Anand, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's a murky world out there, so it's difficult to say one way or the other.
And we're glad you're in that world, Anand. Anand Gopal is a reporter in the murky world of Kabul, Afghanistan. He reports for the Wall Street Journal. Coming up, we talk about work every Tuesday, and if you're in a murky world or otherwise, if you don't have a job, an internship could be the answer if you want a job change or just get a load of a totally different workplace. Beth Koblenzer has some interesting stories, some interesting suggestions, and we'll talk with someone who's actually done it. More later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Now, he was apparently supposed to die back in 2003. Ahmed Al-Shayaya, the man whose voice you're about to hear, drove a truck full of explosives into the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad.
I was sitting in a bowl of fire, screaming, and everything was burning. People were shooting at me. I didn't know where the bullets were coming from, but I jumped through the window into the ground, and then I ran.
He ended up killing 9 innocent people, but Al-Shayaya was not killed. He was caught, sent to Saudi Arabia for what is known as jihad rehab. His treatment there, coloring, drawing, and making papier-mâché at what used to be a holiday resort center. This is the same treatment program prescribed for one of the men reportedly affiliated now with the al-Qaeda group that took responsibility for the plot to blow up that Northwest Airlines flight on Christmas Day. Owen Bennett-Jones is the host of the BBC NewsHour, and he visited that jihad rehab center back in 2008. Good morning, Owen.
Good morning to you.
So what's the feel of this rehab program, and what do they aim to accomplish here?
Well, it's not as you describe it, really. I mean, there is some art therapy, which does seem a bit odd, but it's one very minor part of the whole process. The vast bulk of it takes two forms, really, or three. The first is religious re-education, which is not really persuading people that things like the American intervention in Iraq was correct, because you'll never do that. But it is persuading them that it's wrong to declare jihad personally, that that should be a governmental decision, and getting these people to admit that they should have not gone to Iraq to fight, for example. Second element is that they pay them really very substantial sums of money, like $33,000 for getting married, plus a job, plus a flat, to try and resettle them into civilian life. And the third thing, just quickly to mention, is that the families are involved and take responsibility for the good behavior of their relatives.
And here's one of the doctors from that program, Dr. Awad Al-Yami. He spoke in 2008 when you were there reporting. Listen to this.
Get that negative energy out on the paper. It's safe here. It's on the paper. It's not outside.
That sounds a little bit like, you know, a clip from the Oprah show here in the United States. I mean, there is a certain amount of psychology here in addition to the incentives you've already described, right?
Well, yeah, as I say, it's a very small part of the course. I think it's something like an hour a week compared to, 50 hours or something else. And, of course, the Americans are using this art therapy themselves in the Iraqi camps. Apparently, soft pastels and curvy lines are an indication of a peaceful intent. Well, I mean, you know, I wasn't entirely convinced by that, but I just must say that it was not really what the course was about.
But if anything, today we would be even less convinced that this course would work, given the situation now with the Christmas alleged bombing of the Northwest flight. It seems that people who come out of this program are not necessarily cured. What's the sense of a success rate?
Well, that's contested. I mean, when I was there, they said 92 had gone through it and none had reoffended, and that was about 18 months ago. Since then, partly, I think, because the people left in Guantanamo tend to be the more committed jihadists, so they're getting tougher cases to deal with. Since then, there have been some failures, no doubt. The guy who's running al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula is a former Guantanamo detainee who's been through the program, and there are other examples you can point to, but of course there are many successes. And I've interviewed people from Guantanamo now in Yemen, in Saudi and Pakistan. And my impression, but of course these are the ones prepared to meet me as a Western reporter, my impression is that most of them have had enough and they just want to have a quiet life. Well, so in a way, the Saudi program is pushing on an open door. So, you know, it does have substantial success, but not complete success.
And it's in competition with the radicalization of people in places like Guantanamo directly. Owen Bennett-Jones, host of the NewsHour from the BBC, thank you so much.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. And coming up, we talk about work every Tuesday. So if you're out of work, and stay with me on this, maybe an unpaid internship is the way to find a new job. We're going to talk about that in a few moments. We're also talking to you about flying all morning long. What do you think about the new restrictions?
My name is Annie. I think everybody should be patted down personally. I think that way then no one feels left out. Next thing you know, it'll be Americans. There are American people that would love to get involved with Al-Qaeda. So I just think everybody should be double-checked and triple-checked.
What security measures do you think would be going too far? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or email us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org. Let's check in on the leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. In Afghanistan, the suicide bomber who killed seven CIA officers last week was a double agent. The New York Times reports the man was a Jordanian doctor who was taken onto the base because it was hoped he'd deliver top members of Al-Qaeda to the CIA. Here at home, the Times reports different signals from the economy. It says manufacturing expanded last month and new jobless claims fell last week, but the paper warns what it calls the Great Recession has been replaced by what might be called, quote, the Great Ambiguity.
Really catchy there. A leading Muslim group in the U.S. says it's not happy with those new anti-terrorism screening measures for airline passengers. They say it undermines the Obama administration's attempts to rebuild relations with Muslim countries. It's the Muslim Public Affairs Council. An Arctic chill is running through the eastern half of the U.S., even as far as south as Florida, where farmers are scrambling to save crops from the freezing temperatures. And, you know, if it doesn't work out on this planet, climate-wise or any other way, scientists have found, we discover, five new planets orbiting stars that are actually near to us. William Borucki is the science principal investigator for the NASA Kepler mission. Are those five planets possible alternatives for us if things don't work out here on Earth?
No, they're not. They're giant planets, generally. Some of them very strange. All of them extremely hot. Hotter than, in fact, molten lava. They're so hot they actually glow.
All right, so global warming is way beyond global warming in these five planets. What's the scientific significance of this discovery, and how were they detected?
Well, first of all, the significance is the fact that we're trying to understand planets themselves. In our own solar system, we have sort of three types of planets. We have planets like the Earth that are sort of made of rock and iron with an iron core. Then we have planets that are sort of made mostly of ice and water. And then we have planets that are mostly gas, hydrogen gas. And so with other solar systems, we're looking at those kinds of planets, trying to understand how they come about, and try to understand why our solar system seems so to be so different than these other planetary systems. So it's a matter of getting information about them to understand our own system.
And the Kepler mission is all about detecting these new planets in stars near to the Earth. How far away are these five planets quickly?
They're probably about 1,000 light years away.
All right. William Borucki is the science principal investigator for the Kepler mission, discovering five new planets orbiting stars that are actually relatively nearby to us. Thank you, Professor.
We talk about work every Tuesday on The Takeaway, but I think this is the first time, at least while I've been here, that we've talked about unpaid work. Unpaid work for grown-ups. We're not talking about 21-year-olds, people fresh out of high school. We are talking about people in their 30s, 40s, and sometimes older, who are taking either very low-paid or unpaid internships in order to maybe learn new skills, get their foot in the door on new careers. To talk about this is our work contributor, Beth Kobliner. Also joining us is Kelly Barbieri. She was, up until November, an adult intern herself. Good morning to both of you.
Hi.
So, Beth, explain this to us. There's a certain number of people who are now taking unpaid or low-paid internships?
Right. Absolutely. And at first when I heard this, I thought, who can afford it? You know? I mean, who has the money to not work and not get paid? And the more I looked into it, it became clear that it's a whole lot better than sitting at home waiting for the phone to ring with a job offer. We're really talking about the idea of an internship. You know, it brings to mind the notion of people schlepping coffee to their boss, you know, and there's nothing worse than thinking about doing that in your 40s and 50s. However, this can actually pay off. We've talked about this before on the show with seasonal jobs,
right.
How you take something temporary and you turn it into something bigger. And this is happening now more and more. And there are signs that there are opportunities that are not quite being exploited, because a poll showed that even though 55% of companies say they would hire older interns, very few companies, only 7%, say people over 50 actually apply. So there's a way to get in there, and it's a way to show your stuff, use some experience, and get some experience that you may actually really, really need, like digital media, like if you work for a business, you want to learn the nonprofit world. It really gives you a short-term opportunity to learn something you really will use and skills that you can learn and use in your next job.
Well, this is exactly what Kelly Barbieri has actually done. So, Kelly, let's get the lowdown from you. You took an unpaid internship?
Yes.
And how long were you doing this internship?
From July to early November.
And were you schlepping coffee? Were you?
No, actually, it was a very small company, so I was able to get exactly what I needed and give them exactly what they needed. So it was a very good thing.
Let's kind of get the timeline for you. You had a career in print journalism.
15 years.
Okay, and then you were laid off.
Correct.
And so you decided to take an unpaid internship because...
Well, I was job hunting after the last company downsized tremendously inside of a couple of months, and I just didn't see any print jobs out there. So I had been looking at online journalism for a long time. I had my own website. I love internet and all of that. So I just decided to make the jump over. And in order to do that, I needed to learn exactly what happens in the office every day.
And that turned into a full-time gig.
Yeah.
You're now the managing editor of Relocation.com.
Yes.
But so, did you get to learn like HTML code and writing using Photoshop?
I took classes on the side as well, and that was supplemental. But I've always been a person who learned better from real life experience. So the classes combined with the internship just worked really, really well.
Pretty great.
And what was really cool to me was Kelly was telling me earlier that she didn't go in there like, I'm the wise old person. I mean, you're not old, but you look really young.
That's what I would do.
Yeah. You know, like, I'll teach you young folk what to do. You went in there and said, this is all new to me. You know, a lot of this is new to me. Could you teach me? And I think that kind of approaching it with passion, you know, suck it up, don't really rise, sort of what I tell my 14-year-old daughter. You know, like, go in there,
you're
be open.
A losing battle with death.
Yeah, I know.
It helped also that I had interns. So I know what makes a good intern and what makes a bad intern, and I know the interns that do well.
It can't be easy, though, Kelly, when you've distinguished yourself in a career, and all, you know, you weren't going into a completely unrelated field, and maybe that contributed your
right.
success, that you were just kind of fuguing on a theme. But it cannot be easy to go in there and suddenly be the peon in your workplace.
Well, I mean, it was either do that or not work.
Mm-hmm.
So the choice was pretty easy. And I don't think in life you ever get to a point where you stop learning. So it was just the next step for me, and the ability to keep on learning in a situation that was real life was an excellent, excellent opportunity. And I'd like to thank yourtango.com for that opportunity. It was wonderful.
Nice little plug in.
is a factory welder going to have this opportunity?
Well,
I was going to say, you know, it really depends upon, again, you have to think about, the factory welder has to think about, well, what would I like to do if I would look into another opportunity? And I think, you know, there are a lot of trade associations. For example, if that factory welder feels like there's some other aspect of some other industry I'd be interested in, checking out maybe some trade associations that may offer some opportunities.
I used to be a factory welder, actually, in the
yeah.
70s. And I interned at a public radio station.
That's great. And that, I keep hearing these stories of people who have done that. You know, Sara Lee Company, the cake people, they have now a returnship for people who worked, women particularly, who worked in other fields, or then became full-time moms, worked in the PTA, community service, and now come back to the workplace. You know, big investment banks like Goldman Sachs are doing it for women, and small nonprofits are doing it.
Wow.
So it's really all over the board. And like you say, it's sort of figuring out what you want to do and trying to get an internship in it.
It sounds like if you combine it with other learning opportunities, then you could build yourself a new career. Thanks
Definitely.
So much, Beth Koblenz, Takeaway contributor, and Kelly Barbieri. Congratulations.
Thank you.
New managing editor of Relocation.com.
Forever, forever, you've got to give me that internship.
if you have a story to share, kind of like my co-hosts of interning somewhere and then making career out of it, 8778, my take.
By the way, earlier on the show, you know, I work with a net. It's called Our Listeners. I said that Congress passed baseball's antitrust exemption, talking about the NFL's upcoming Supreme Court case. But Lloyd emailed me and said, no, it came from the Supreme Court back in 1922. Thank you,
History
Lloyd.
History buff Lloyd. Thank you. Lloyd. Thank you. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Forever, you've got a better name than most. I think you need me to vacuum up the carpet and be the best.
Need something done on the Arabian Peninsula? Just talk to the Saudis. The U.S. has been doing that since 1945.
One of the most colorful visits to the presidential cruiser was that of the ruler of Saudi Arabia, King Ibn Saud. The 65-year-old monarch leaves his country for the first time to attend this meeting. Understanding each other's problems brings East and West together for a better world.
But the House of Saud is a family business, and not every Arab benefits. Just ask the people of Yemen next door. The difficulty of not being a Saudi on the Arabian Peninsula, it's a problem we maybe need to understand much better in 2010.
It's a family affair.
Family affair. Family affairs, global tensions on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, January 5th, 2010, and The Takeaway is how tensions between Yemen and Saudi Arabia may actually be the backdrop for the latest instability on the Arabian Peninsula.
Latest instability, meaning how it distinguishes it from the other instability in the Arabian Peninsula, is another question.
Well, certainly why Yemen is in the headlines these days, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Let's get to the top stories we're following this morning. More information about the suicide bomber who killed seven CIA officers in Afghanistan last week. He was reportedly a Jordanian doctor recruited by Jordanian intelligence and taken to the CIA base because he claimed to have information about Al-Qaeda's second-in-command. But the bomber was a double agent. He blew himself up in the meeting, killing seven CIA officers and a Jordanian spy. Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, Anand Gopal of The Wall Street Journal in Afghanistan told us it's difficult to target Al-Qaeda leaders because most are in Pakistan.
The intelligence becomes a problem, then it becomes very difficult to get these leaders.
Last night, the top NATO intelligence officials released a report saying the CIA is only, quote, marginally relevant in Afghanistan. The report says the CIA focuses too much on the enemy and not enough on civilian life.
In Yemen, the U.S. embassy is now open. This comes less than a day after Yemeni forces say they killed two Al-Qaeda militants who were behind a threat to those embassies. For the latest, we're joined by New York Times Paris bureau chief Stephen Erlanger, who's in Sana'a in Yemen. Yemen has long been defined, Stephen, as the nation that is not Saudi Arabia there on the peninsula. I'm wondering if these current headlines are fueled by those longstanding tensions between Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
Well, that's part of the factor. I mean, there has been a long tension, but ever since 9/11 and the rise of Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda's main target is Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia's understood that, you know, the security of Yemen is partly its security also. So, in fact, they've toned down the meddling in Yemen, and in fact, last year provided the Yemeni government $2 billion in cash to help it cover its budget deficit. I mean, though the rivalries are there, and there are issues of religion and also tribal control, it is also true that the Saudis see the stability of Yemen now is very important given the threat of Al-Qaeda.
Well, let's hold on to all of those thoughts. So we're going to talk about the relations between Yemen and Saudi Arabia with Stephen Erlanger in just a moment.
The United Nations Food Agency has stopped distributing food in southern Somalia because of attacks against staff and demands that women be removed from the aid teams. The region is largely controlled by an Islamic group linked to Al-Qaeda.
We want to remind you, President Obama is going to be meeting with his national security team this afternoon. He's expected to announce at about 4 p.m. Eastern Time further changes to airline security watch lists.
And astronomers using the new Kepler telescope have discovered five new planets, all larger than Earth. One has the density of styrofoam.
Wouldn't
good news
go there.
McDonald's.
Wouldn't want to go
two
there.
Two others have surfaces hotter than molten lava.
Not quite good.
Last two are inexplicably hotter than the stars that they orbit.
Well, cross them off the list. Futures. Asian markets are up. European indices are now mixed with that sad news. Futures are down slightly. The Dow gets underway at 10,583. The S&P opens at 1,132. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,308.
Problems in Colorado. Mixed messages, actually. They have a great new incoming population, a population surge. But at the same time, they're trying to deal with that while they have a recession and state funding is down. And we're talking to you about flying all morning long. How much do you think you should have to go through before you get onto a plane? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
Well, it's been said before, we just said it a few moments ago, the nation of Yemen, this morning the focus of global concerns about terrorism, has been defined as being the nation that is not Saudi Arabia there on the Arabian Peninsula. Yemen's neighbor to the north and west, Saudi Arabia, Yemen has never benefited from the fabulous oil wealth on the peninsula, long controlled by the Saudi royal family. Bitterness from the people of Yemen and even ethnic Yemenis inside Saudi Arabia has fueled insurgency there for decades. And one of al-Qaeda's original missions, Steve Erlanger of the New York Times pointed this out a moment ago, long before 9/11, al-Qaeda's mission was to bring down the royal family in Saudi Arabia. But what makes Yemen a terrorism hotspot, at least if you read the headlines this week? That's simple, says restaurant worker Ahmed Suleiman, a Yemeni from Brooklyn who talked about his home country yesterday.
Yemen's basically empty. You know, it has like 22 million people, but there's a lot of areas where you go miles and miles without seeing anybody. Nobody really pays attention to it. You know, it's in the Arabian Peninsula, but it's never really been heard of that much. It's a perfect place for terrorism.
Perfect place for terrorism. To discuss that is Steve Erlanger, who rejoins us. He's a reporter for our partner, the New York Times, and joins us for the from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. And Charles Sennett is the executive editor for the Global Post. He's been on the program many times and joins us from Boston. Good morning, Charlie.
Morning, John.
Steve, let me continue that thread there. You know, not to equate, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations analysis of Yemen with a restaurant worker in Brooklyn, but in a sense, there's a certain amount of agreement that Yemen has some real difficulties, both geographically and ethnically, in resisting the kinds of instability that's resulted in the terrorist allegations that we're looking at this week.
That's absolutely true. I mean, basically, Yemen, people may remember, used to be two countries, North Yemen and South Yemen, one socialist, one not. The Saudis always played along the border with the loyalties of tribes. The Saudis promoted a kind of Salafist Islam in Yemen. They both fought together against what they considered a Shia rebellion in the northern Yemen near Sada. But at the same time, Yemen has very little oil and it's running out. The government is fragile. It has lost much of the territory outside the capital to tribal control. There are very few government authorities outside the main cities. So huge parts of Yemen are, as your restaurant worker said, essentially empty lands. Hmm. They're lands where dragons lie. They're places that have very little electricity, very little water. That's kind of Bedouin, but places where there's very little government authority and where al-Qaeda can take refuge.
Well, there's a great takeaway. Lands where dragons lie. Steve Erlanger, reporter for our partner in the New York Times. Give us a sense of what people in Sana'a are making of these claims by the Yemeni government that they've killed two al-Qaeda militants. The U.S. Embassy, I understand, has reopened. What are people saying?
Well, there was definitely a specific threat. The American and British embassies closed together two days ago, and the little skirmish that happened yesterday was only about 25 miles north of the capital, and though no one is very clear about this, it seems that these people near Al-Harb were part of what was considered the direct threat to the capital. So after the skirmish, which after all didn't kill the main person they were after, but just bodyguards, people began to relax a bit, and the embassies are slowly opened. Nobody's been very clear about cause and effect, but that's what it seems like right now.
It's interesting. We can hear the midday call of the Muezzin there in Sana'a. Steve Erlanger, Paris reporter for The New York Times, thanks so much for that latest update there from Yemen. Charlie Sennett, I remember your reporting right after 9/11 from Saudi Arabia near the Yemeni border, describing how ethnically it was so different and how the tensions politically and otherwise in that region and across the border were really long standing. What do you think is going on today?
I think, you know, what we're seeing today is just what happens when you fail to manage a struggle against terrorism and you don't pay attention. You allow places like Yemen to become the lands where dragons lie. And that is a beautiful phrase that Steve just made. But it is so true that that sort of untamed land of the Asir province in Saudi Arabia and then crossing over to the border to Yemen, that's where the bin Laden family is from. That is their bin Laden's father's ancestral home. That is a place where we haven't paid enough attention, and I think we're seeing that come back on us now. I don't know if you remember, of course you remember the Cole attack in 2000, but then in 2006 there was this big prison break where many of the suspects in the Cole bombing escaped, and presumably escaped with the help of some government officials. And that group that escaped is really what's considered this core that has reconstituted itself now as Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
Oh, that's a great fact that you're reminding us there. And, you know, our restaurant worker who we referred to, who our producer Femi Oke talked with yesterday, also had some things to say about the Yemeni government. Listen to this, Charlie.
The Yemeni government is corrupt. That even society in Yemen is corrupt now. So maybe it's a good thing that this is happening. That's what people are saying. Maybe it's a way to clean things up.
Well, to paraphrase there, Ahmed Suleiman, a restaurant worker in Brooklyn, is this possibly coming to a head, and could that be a good thing for people who are cynical about the Yemeni government?
It's going to take a lot more commitment of resources, financial, military, and intelligence. Many more assets need to be brought to bear. You know, back in 2006, when those guys escaped, we gave $5 million in aid to Yemen for counterterrorism. We're now talking about doubling the $60 million that we give them currently to a little over $120 million. This is a drop in the bucket. This is not going to have any real serious impact, and particularly not with, as Steve's pointed out, and he has a really strong story today about how corrupt and unpredictable and fickle this government is. And I just feel like Yemen becomes one of those classic cases in point where if you don't pay attention to everything and every detail on the ground, you're going to create a place where Al-Qaeda can once again metastasize and grow. And it's going to require the Obama administration to really step up its game in counterterrorism globally if it's going to be effective.
You know, it seems like there are so many places, Charlie, in the world that might fit that description. Our focus, though, today is Yemen. Charlie Sennett is executive editor and founder of Global Post, on the line from his home in Boston, Massachusetts. And at 15 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at some of the other headlines that we're looking at this morning.
A member of the House Intelligence Committee has said double agents are common in Afghanistan. Dutch Ruppersberger was speaking after it was revealed that a Jordanian double agent was responsible for the suicide attack last week that killed 7 CIA officers. Mr. Ruppersberger said any informant needed to be carefully vetted.
The breakdown was clear. I think more and more, though, when you're dealing in Afghanistan and even Iraq, you know, you have double agents and people working both sides.
The people of Iceland are to vote in a referendum on whether to pay more than $5 billion to Britain and the Netherlands. The money would be compensation for the cash paid out by those two governments to cover losses suffered by their savers when Iceland's banks collapsed in 2008. The Dutch government said the referendum is unacceptable.
Back at home, it's seriously cold in the eastern half of the United States, and that's not likely to change. Temperatures in the Florida panhandle have been dipping into the 20s. Waves of Arctic air are making it extremely cold in Mississippi and Alabama. And it's not just here in the U.S. Arctic weather is causing problems across the northern hemisphere. Northeast Asia is experiencing its coldest winter in 60 years. Business news. General Motors says its sales in China surged 67% last year, but revenues from GM sales in the U.S. market are actually higher. That's because GM sells its vehicles in China for less than they do here at home. Some sad news. Johnson & Johnson heiress Casey Johnson was found dead yesterday in her Los Angeles home. A police spokeswoman says Johnson may have died from natural causes. No sign of foul play so much. That's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
Coming up. We bring you some takeouts, and we're going to talk about Google's new phone. It could change the cell phone market. More in a minute.
Hey, you want that to go?
Takeout time? No. Wonk out time. Here's a story we would never follow, but for the discussion about healthcare in the United States, the cost of healthcare in the United States. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, was there for the release at midnight of the cost of healthcare. How much Americans spent on healthcare in 2008? It's actually a pretty interesting number. Good morning, Todd.
Wonk out time. Hi, John. Okay, when we talk about healthcare, John, we have to unfortunately use numbers that start with a T. $2.3 trillion is the latest. Yeah, and it's the latest national number on healthcare spending. It's about 16.2% of the economy. Wow. This breaks down to right around $7,700 for every man, woman, and child in America, regardless of insurance status. That's the per capita number. Now, there's good news and there's bad news in this number. Here's the good news. Healthcare spending grew at 4.4% in 2008, and while that's a lot, it's the slowest rate of growth in 50 years. In fact, since the government's been tracking this number. So that's great news. You know, the slowest they've had since 1960. But here's the bad news. The economy grew at 2.6%. So what that means is even though 4.4% is the best number we've had in 50 years, it's still outpacing the economy. It's still outpacing wages. And that means it's still unsustainable, even in the best of times. That's what that number means.
What's the reason for the slowing of growth? We were talking about recession in our newscast this morning, but how does that break down?
Right. Well, recession slows down all spending, so that includes healthcare too. Hospital spending is the largest sector of spending in healthcare, and hospitals are spending less. We're spending less on hospital care. Another big one is pharmaceuticals. People are spending less on drugs, you know, because they have their copays and their tiered payments and their insurance plans. So when you have to spend your own money, you just spend less on it. Also, elective drugs like Ambien, like Viagra. People spend less on those, and there are fewer drugs that are in the pipeline in drug companies, so they're not putting out as many big expensive drugs as they used to.
Well, slowest growth since 1960. We'll see how that figures into the healthcare debate. Takeaway Washington contributor Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
Let's move on to cell phones with John Abel, New York Bureau Chief for Wired.com. And this is potentially big news, right, John? Google, the search corporation, is going to unveil the Nexus One smartphone. It's their first their latest venture, I should say, into the cell phone market. But the big headline here is that this cell phone is unlocked. What does that mean, John?
Yeah, it's unlocked. You've been able to get an unlocked phone in the United States for years. People tend not to do it because when you buy it through the carrier, you pay a lot less. But this is what could happen. If Google comes out with a branded phone that people like, that is similar to the look and feel and the happiness therein of the iPhone, and people are willing to pay for it, this could put a lot of pressure on the phone companies, the wireless companies, to allow people to pick and choose their contracts with the phone they bring to the table.
So when you buy this phone, are the cell companies then going to allow you to use it with their service?
Well, they've all said, in theory, that they want to open up their networks. As a practical matter, the Nexus One phone, which we're speaking of as a reality, even though it isn't quite yet, will be a GSM phone. There are only two GSM carriers in this country, AT&T and T-Mobile, and the rumor is that T-Mobile will offer a contract and a subsidized price. But the long-term view is that, yes, once you disconnect the phone, the handset part, from the service part, then the service has to become more competitive.
And is this a risk for Google?
Not really. This is not a material business for Google. They can afford to make many mistakes in the design of handsets, and people will say, oh, well, they're just Google. But they could hit a double or a triple right out of the bat with this phone. There's a lot of attention. They're doing it by the Apple playbook. They're announcing it the day before CES starts in earnest, which is what Apple did with the iPhone 3 years ago. So they're certainly building expectations that they believe very much in this product.
Okay, John Abel, New York Bureau Chief for Wired.com.
Our last takeout is about sports and a bit of a somber note. We figured eventually our listeners would notice. Remember Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen?
What happened to Ibrahim Abdul, that wonderful sportscaster you had? He was the only sportscaster I ever heard that I liked, and he's suddenly gone, and you're not saying a word about him.
It's because Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is back, and why were you gone for not very long, really? That's serious fan penetration there.
That's very heartfelt. I got married.
Congratulations.
Yay. Thank you.
Congratulations.
All right. Well, we are here to talk about sports. Yes. And on the first day of your wedding, your marriage, you're working.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you got to make things happen.
You got to make things happen. All right. So the Tostitos Fiesta Bowl was last night. And it is a very happy day in Idaho this morning. What happened?
It is. Well, okay, so Boise State, led by their coach Chris Peterson, who's a National Coach of the Year, and a stingy defense, they beat Texas Christian University, TCU, 17-10. And it was an interesting game because in the fourth quarter, Boise State had a fake punt on their own 33-yard line, and they have a sort of a history of using trick plays in big games. 2007, they played Oklahoma for the Fiesta Bowl, and they ended up winning the game on a series of trick plays. So that was one interesting fact. But this is a part of the BCS thing. These were the first two undefeated teams meeting in a BCS game that was
BCS Bowl Championship Series
that was not the championship game. So this had some historic potential there.
What does this mean going forward? Is Boise State likely to be a power next year and the year after, or is this a blip?
The problem with Boise State is that they play in the WAC conference, which isn't that they're WAC, but it's the WAC conference, and they're not a strong conference. So the strength of their schedule doesn't put them in contention for a national title. However, you do have guys like Darryl Washington from TCU, Kyle Wilson from Piscataway, New Jersey, who plays for Boise State. Those are guys like Titus Jones from Boise State. Those are guys that you'll see in the NFL in the coming years.
Right. Quickly, the FedEx Orange Bowl, number 10 Iowa, number 9 Georgia Tech. What do you think?
The thing to watch here is that Georgia Tech's number 2 rushing offense versus Iowa's number 30 rushing defense.
Ooh, 30 versus 2. That gives Georgia the advantage on the ground. Iowa will have to improve its defense by tonight. Takeaway Sports contributor, and congratulations to Ibrahim Abdul-Bateen. Thanks so much. Coming up, how can we make our airlines secure? The government's asking that question. But we're going to ask the former security head of an Israeli airline, El Al. The country has some of the strictest security measures in the world. Could it work on a global scale? More on that in a few minutes.
Coming up, we'll talk more about airline security restrictions and when they are not enough, when they are too much. We'll talk to the former security head for the National Israeli Airline in just a few moments. First, here's some of the stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. The suicide bomber who killed 7 CIA officers in Afghanistan last week was reportedly a Jordanian doctor recruited by Jordanian intelligence. He was taken to a CIA base because he claimed to have information on Al-Qaeda's second-in-command, but the bomber was a double agent. He blew himself up at the meeting, and he killed 7 CIA officers along with a Jordanian intelligence official. Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, a member of the House Intelligence Committee, says this incident should not detract from the CIA's global role.
We know that as a result of the individual not being checked, that this has caused a huge tragedy. But I wouldn't confuse that breakdown of security check with the ongoing work that our agents are doing on the ground, both in Afghanistan and other parts of the world.
In Yemen, the U.S. embassy has reopened. It comes less than a day after Yemeni forces say they killed 2 al-Qaeda militants during a gun battle.
More on the CIA. The CIA and the nation's top climatologists are working together again. The New York Times is reporting that scientists now have access to spy satellites and classified sensors as they track natural phenomena like glaciers and sea levels worldwide. The collaboration had been shut down during the Bush administration. President Obama, we want to remind you, will meet with his national security team this afternoon, where he's expected to announce further changes to those airline security watch lists and all the security arrangements that are now under discussion. A Portland man is accused of cutting women's hair without their knowledge as they rode on a city bus. Okay, it's not the biggest headline, but it is unusual. Cops say the 22-year-old is also suspect in several hair gluing incidents in recent weeks. He faces third-degree robbery charges. Hair gluing. How does that look on your resume? Not good at all. No real trend on Wall Street as the markets get underway. The Dow is about 5 points below where it closed yesterday at 10,579. The S&P is also unchanged at this point. The NASDAQ just a fraction down. That's some of the stories that we're looking at this morning.
You've probably heard about new airline security restrictions. Passengers from 14 specific countries will undergo stricter security when they try to fly to the United States, including Nigeria, Yemen, Iran, Pakistan, Cuba. Some people say the new restrictions are discriminatory. Others say we're not going far enough. Joining us now is Isaac Yefet. He's the former head of security for the Israeli airline El Al. Good morning, Isaac.
Good morning to you.
You feel as though the security restrictions on the part of the United States are not going far enough. Why do you say that?
because we don't learn from one tragedy how to prevent the next tragedy. And I'll give an example. In 1988, Pan American over Lockerbie, 272 people lost their life. What did we learn from this? Nothing. September 11, 2001, 3,000 people lost their life. What did we learn from this? Nothing. The only thing that the FAA was out, the TSA in. They have nice uniform, but results, nothing.
What?
The shoe bomber, Richard Reed, he hid his explosive in his shoes. What was the result of this? To punish all the American people who are flying. Take off your shoes when you come to the airport. Now, a new system, another patch on top of patch that we do. The Nigerian guy, Abdul Muttalib, he hid his explosive in his underwear. The solution or the results? We all now will go to the airport and we will be seen naked. If this is the security that we are looking for, just a patch on top of patch, why we cannot, after one tragedy or incident, to sit and to investigate and to come to a conclusion what was wrong in our system, why we cannot build a security system that will prevent any incident or tragedy in the future? Are we going to go this way and to punish the American people? It's about time to change this security system.
Well,
why
it appears...
we don't think twice?
It appears we're also punishing anyone traveling to the United States. That begs the question, if we can't plug every leak, if we can't prevent terrorists from coming up with other ways to circumvent security restrictions, what is that blanket policy that will make sure we're not allowing violent people onto our airplanes?
I'll tell you what we do with El Al. We have the profiling system. We call it interview. People call it profiling. It's okay. The profiling system can give us the best solution. And I'll give you an example. At Heathrow, London, Irish pregnant woman asked her boyfriend that she wants him to marry her. He said, I'll do it, but by our tradition, you have to go to Israel to visit my family, get the blessing, come back, I'll marry you immediately. She was so happy. He packed the luggage. He bought her the ticket. He drove her to Heathrow Airport and told her, this is the luggage is full with presents for my family. Let them be happy. She was very happy. She has a real passport. The luggage went through the X-ray machine, and I'll come to the X-ray machine, and nothing was identified. When she came to our guys, the security guys at the airport, through a simple question that she was asked, the poor woman did not know what they want from her, and she couldn't answer simple questions. So immediately they decided to check her as a suspicious. When they opened the luggage, they found more than 4 kilos of explosives. This is the present that he sent with her to his family, to kill 747 with 400 passengers, including this innocent Irish pregnant woman.
How long does this add to each passenger's trip? If you're going to be interviewing them and profiling them.
I'll tell you. It depends on the answer that we get. It depends on the information that we have from the intelligence. Normally, most of the passengers are bona fide, are honest. If you know how to approach them and to tell them that we do it for their safety, because we stay on the ground, they take the flight. We want to make sure that all the passengers will arrive safe and secure to their destination. If you are honest, you are so happy to cooperate with us because you understand why we are doing it. It might take 3 minutes. It might take 5 minutes. Suspicious passengers, yes, it takes longer because we don't leave any piece in the luggage or in the body that we don't search.
How do you make this scalable, though? How do you translate this particular policy, which you say is working well for El Al, into a policy that's going to work for thousands upon thousands of passengers?
Millions.
Yeah, flying every year to the United States.
Let me ask you a question. What's the difference between 747 of El Al that comes to JFK and 747 of American Air Carriers or any other air carriers? 747 of El Al, they need a separate gate, the same other aircraft. They need a separate catering. They need separate cargo. They need separate luggage. They need separate gate for the passengers. How we do it every day, few times a day, with not even one delay. If you know how to hire the right people, qualified, train them well, test them nonstop to make sure to bring them to a point where the test and the read should be the same. And if anyone who failed, he is out. No mercy in this kind of work. We are dealing with life. So if Al can do it, why we cannot do it? Right. Number two, why in this country that we have over 400 airports around the country, why we cannot take one airport and to try to build Al Al system with the profiling and to learn if it's possible, if we can implement it, we cannot implement it, what are the problems, etc., etc. But just to make statement that we are a big air carrier, millions of people are flying. I don't see any difference between El Al aircraft and any other aircraft.
Thanks so much, Isaac Yefet, the former head of El Al Security. That's the national airline of Israel. He's also a former Israeli intelligence officer. And coming up, welcome to our new listeners in Denver. Colorado. I want to come home. Colorado, lots and lots of people moving in during a recession. Talking about that soon.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Yesterday, the Obama administration lifted its ban on travelers who are HIV positive. Martin Rooney was one of those people who was refused entry into the U.S. at the Canadian border in 2007, but he crossed that border yesterday. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. So tell me what it was like when you crossed the border yesterday. Any trouble?
Not any trouble. It was overwhelming. I was pulled over. And obviously because I was marked, and I had a letter with me, from an email from the White House and Homeland Security that should that happen, here was a telephone number to call. So once they saw that document or email, within 15 minutes, we were allowed to cross.
You're an advocate for the rights of those who are HIV or AIDS positive, and you yourself are HIV positive. Back in 2007, you couldn't get in the United States. What happened then?
Basically, I arrived at the border. I was denied entry because of my medical status, and that was gotten out of me by the general questions that were asked. And I was asked what I did for employment. I explained I was on disability, and when I was asked what my disability was, I said it was HIV.
So you said you're now marked. Your vehicle is marked? Or your driver's license? Or?
Well, I think on my personal files, I'm labeled as having HIV. I think the whole process yesterday was, in fact, to remove that.
And how was the process? Was it respectful? Was it?
Yes, it was much, much more respectful. It was less stressful. I had no doubt that I was going to be able to get across the border yesterday.
You didn't?
I did.
You had a doubt?
Oh, no, I had no doubt in the deep recess of my heart and my mind that I would be able to get across, and that, in fact, did happen.
So you're someone who advocates for the rights of people who do have AIDS or HIV positive, and yesterday that must have been a big step as you either drove or walked across the border into the U.S.
Well, it was nice to be able to drive again because I've been doing it for 20 years before they stopped me. I live 15 minutes from a drive-through entry point, and it was an overwhelming, a very empowering moment once I got to the other side.
You know, Martin, this seems like a story of what we considered a threat, rightly or wrongly, you know, as recently as 5 years ago versus, you know, all these airline restrictions because of terror allegations, what we consider a threat today. A lot's changed since this ban was put into effect.
I've always referenced the fact that HIV, to pass that on has to be specific actions. It's not a threat. It was never a threat to the public health security of the United States. I happen to feel that that was a very right-wing political agenda against the HIV/AIDS community and possibly the GLBTQ community. There is no medical proof that this ever was a public health threat to the United States.
Well, welcome to the United States every time that you travel in, Martin Rooney, an advocate for people with HIV and AIDS, successfully crossed the border into the United States from British Columbia yesterday because of a change in regulations the Obama administration lifted after years, a ban on travelers who are HIV positive to the U.S.
Thanks so much, Martin.
Thank you.
Keep the conversation going with your thoughts. Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, growth in Colorado and the growing pains that comes with it, in honor of our latest community of listeners to The Takeaway. We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. All hands on deck. President Obama is holding a high-level meeting on airport security today. The White House says the president will announce new steps to thwart terror attacks after the session sometime this afternoon. It's all in response to that botched Christmas Day terror attack. Overseas, the U.S. and British embassies have reopened in Yemen after security threats kept them shuttered for 2 days. Back home, authorities have made an arrest in connection with a fire in Northampton, Massachusetts that claimed the life of an elderly man and his son. Prosecutors say a 25-year-old man is in custody. The blaze is one of 9 fires in the city set within hours of each other.
Teeth will be rattling across the eastern half of the nation as a cold snap settles in for at least a few more days. Parts of New England have had record snowfall. And in the Florida Panhandle, farmers are scrambling to save cold-sensitive crops. In Washington, the Secret Service says it's investigating a third uninvited guest who made his way into the White House state dinner in November. The Washington Post identifies him as Carlos Allen, a party promoter. And astronomers using the new Kepler telescope have found 5 new planets, all of them larger than Earth. One of them has the density of styrofoam. The other two have surfaces of... You could use that to hold false flowers.
Probably
in there.
Not.
2 others have the surfaces hotter than molten lava, and the last two, inexplicably, hotter than the stars that they orbit, for some reason unknown to us. Some of the stories are following this morning.
I guess it's styrofoam or nothing there with those new planets. One more headline, though. We are welcoming a new community of listeners into the Takeaway family. We're on the air in Denver now. New member stations KUVO and KVJZ, and in honor of that... Burrito Bros. Oh, yeah. The headline in Colorado, stay with me here, is that the state has just passed the 5 million population mark. Census projections show the state is expected to gain nearly 800,000 more people during the next 2 decades. That's significantly faster than the national average and, we should note, in the middle of a recession. The numbers aren't new. For the past decade, it's been among the top 5 fastest-growing states. Colorado is still welcoming those newcomers in record numbers. We're going to talk to a few in just a moment. But Bert Hubbard, staff writer for the Denver Post, says that growth comes with good and bad. Bert, I gather it's not so much the what in terms of how many people are coming to the state. It's the who are actually coming into the state that affects what the state needs to do to deal with all this growth, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Basically, Colorado, through this recession, has had a relatively low unemployment rate, which means there are some jobs here to attract people to. Plus, you have just the natural beauty of the state that is attracting a lot of people. But it's not just attracting anybody. It's attracting very highly educated individuals. There's sort of a contradiction in Colorado in that it ranks among the top 3 states in the nation in terms of the percent of people with college degrees, but it ranks relatively low for those people with high school degrees, which means it's really not educated. So
that's pretty interesting. So it's got to be a good thing that there are highly educated people coming to the state, right?
No question. I mean, you're talking disposable incomes, high-paying jobs, everything that a state would love.
But you're saying there's not enough revenue from the highly educated people coming to the state to deal with the cost of actually providing education that you say is needed at the other level among natives in the state.
That's correct. Colorado falls under these constitutional limits, which means that even if everybody floods into Colorado and spends a lot of money, the state government can't spend it all because it's limited to how much it can increase its spending a year. And so all that money that the state government gives either has to go back to the taxpayers or go into reserves. And so they can't start to really fund the solutions to some of the problems, which is one of which is higher education.
So, Bert Hubbard, you're not raining on this whole growth parade, though, are you?
No. Everybody likes to have more people coming in.
All right, well, then let's officially welcome Rajiv Vibhakar, who is a new resident in Denver, Colorado. Good morning, Rajiv.
Good morning.
And Chip Rackus moved to Colorado about a year ago. Chip, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, Rajiv, you're a physician, so you would definitely be in that category of the highly educated people coming. Why'd you come to Colorado?
Really, a couple of reasons. One was the Children's Hospital here in Denver is probably one of the top-ranked children's hospitals and research hospitals in the country, actually. So I used to live in Iowa City, which is a great college town, and never really thought I'd move, but opportunity came up here, and I kind of started thinking about Denver. And once I visited, I sort of fell in love with a lot of things that were just mentioned, both the opportunities plus the outdoors opportunities, which I really just enjoyed a lot.
And it is a little more rockin' than Iowa City, if I do say so myself. But I'm wondering if you're in a position as someone in healthcare to see the lack of infrastructure for people who are native or have been in Colorado for a while in terms of hospital service, the education that Mr. Hubbard talked about a moment ago.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I work both at the Children's Hospital and as part of the University of Colorado Medical Center and the medical school. And it's been an age-old problem with state funding for the medical school and the university. And it's a constant battle every year to try to get funds. And actually, the University of Colorado is among the lowest ranked in terms of state support for medical students, for example. And so we have among the highest tuition rates for in-state students. So there's a significant a problem. It can also be a blessing in disguise because of last year when all the state budgets went south, the University of Colorado relative to, say, the University of Iowa or some other state universities suffered less because they already get almost no money from the state.
Right.
So,
it sounds like you've been in the state for a couple of decades there, Rajiv. Chip Rackus, what's your story of moving to Denver?
Well, we actually did just move back. We were in Hollywood, California for about the last 6 years, and I went to school in Boulder. So I've lived in Colorado before. I love the state. One of the things we realized in Hollywood is that we weren't going to be able to really have the lifestyle that we wanted. I got engaged last spring, and we're actually getting married this coming spring.
Congratulations.
So thank you very much. And we were excited to find a place that we can raise a family with a good sense of community. We love the outdoor lifestyle that Colorado has to offer. It was a really good mix for us to come back here, and we found an area in Denver, actually, that offers a lot of similar things that we liked about Los Angeles. So we were actually able to find some really good things here in Colorado.
Chip, you went to school in Boulder. It's not a little too intense for you there in Denver, is it?
No, not at all. I actually, we love Denver. It's a great town.
Chip and Rajiv, I'm interested in hearing from you. You know, I lived in Arizona, and for a while they were really happy to get lots of new residents coming in from California. But after a while, they were seeing all the development spreading and these new housing and condo units cropping up in the middle of their beautiful desert. And they started saying, whoa, I was okay to move in, but I don't want 10,000, 50,000 more people coming in. Chip?
You know, it's interesting. I actually initially came here to school in 1986. So I've seen the change from 1986 to where we are now. And it's a vastly different state. I mean, I remember when Denver and Boulder were two separate towns, and now there's development continuously through both of them. So it's a very different place. And even back then, I remember there was definitely a sentiment, and it was, a lot of it was geared towards Californians moving in that, they didn't want that kind of growth, but I see a lot of what's happened here, and I think it's been done well. You definitely have more of the urban issues, I think, than you used to have here in Colorado, but...
Well, and you'll be there to deal with them, that's for sure. Chip Rackus, Rajiv Vibhakar, and Bert Hubbard, let's get a last comment from both of you. Are you seeing any tension, Rajiv, between the newbies and the people who have been there for a while?
Honestly, I'm not. I've been really well welcomed. I've lived here a year now, and I absolutely love it. I've lived, New York, Minneapolis, and Denver's definitely been my favorite city. It's a great town, a lot of stuff to do, and the people are really laid back and just have that Western vibe, which I'm really, really enjoying.
Bert Hubbard, are we going to see Don't Californicate Colorado bumper stickers anytime soon in your state?
It's interesting because we had explosive growth in the 1990s, And now there's a real prospect that we may see it this decade, which could inflame the passions all over again.
All right, Bert Hubbard, staff writer for the Denver Post, Rajiv Abakar, who's a physician who recently moved to Denver, Chip Rackus, also recently moved back to Colorado. Thanks to you all and all prospective possible takeaway listeners there in the Denver community. Colorado listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Are you new residents? Why'd you move to Colorado? What do you think of the people who've come in? Tell us your story. Here's one.
Moving from Atlanta to Denver. Curious to see what it's going to be like. I guess I'll know when I get there.
Well, tell us the story when you do get there. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I can tell you now the air will be thinner. While you're at the website to thetakeaway.org, Mark, to look at the blog post from Martin Rooney, who has HIV and was recently just allowed into the U.S. after years of being blocked. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.